I saw a question about business planning. So can we ask Steve if he has a formal business plan?
We did not actually write a formal business plan. So the building that the bakery, the mill bakery is located in is, it's referenced as food building. And, the idea was to put in three local, food producers. One is a Salumiere who produces salami, and sausages, from pigs that are grown in the area. There was a cheese business as well that was sourcing milk, from the area. They've gone out of business. And then there was us. And so, the owner of that building, is a gentleman named Kieran, and he and I put together the project based on our own business experience. We did do financials in terms of projections and that, but we didn't write a formal business plan, per se, because we weren't looking at outside investment. He financed the entire project.
Oh, very cool. How about you, Jenna?
Yes, we did write a business plan. I'm not sure we would have, except that we had, you know, four other business partners who we had to convince that this was a big idea for a pretty substantial investment. So we did write a business plan. We did do projections about what we thought we could produce, how much we thought we could sell, what we thought we could sell it for, what our, you know, areas of growth were going to be, all those things. So we did go through that process.
And are you planning in any way to expand the product line further now?
We will expand based on what the farm is growing still. So I think, you know, last year we grew sesame for the first time, and we haven't really been able to sell it very well just as sesame seeds. So we're doing some tahini, and we're kind of doing some product testing along those lines. But, you know, for us, packaging and has been a challenge, and so we've worked really hard to like get all our labels kind of consistent. And so every time we add something new, it's, you know, we kind of go down this rabbit hole of like getting a label design, getting a label printed, how much should we print? And so I would really like to see us, you know, have our things that we're making and have as consistent a supply of those things as possible, so that we can really make them as nice as we want to make them. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Rob and Charmaine. And I'll moderate a few other questions and really appreciate the activity of the audience providing those questions and remind anybody as we work through these questions, if you have a question, to enter those into the pod that you see on the left. And so we do have a number of questions, and I'll start with you, Jenna. Somebody was interested in the financing and development of your kitchen. The picture that was presented in the presentation looked like just a wonderful workspace. And you did talk about how you self-financed and worked through that kitchen. But to address their question and interest, maybe expand on, if you did it over again, what might you improve upon? What might you address differently on that? And also a follow-up question that somebody put in was working with the county and getting the permits. So if you could address those two issues.
Yeah, you know, we are not architects or really builders. So it was a real, it was really scary to be building something of the size we wanted to build it, and sort of being a little uncertain, you know, how it would turn out. We visited a ton of kitchens in San Francisco, really all over the Bay Area to kind of narrow down what we wanted. And, you know, we went up to this beautiful little farm called the Apple Farm, which is in Philo. And, you know, we had been visiting all these restaurant kitchens in San Francisco, and they all just felt so sleek and, you know, kind of cold and a lot of stainless steel and mostly really tiny. And then we went up to this little farm in Boonville, and it was just, we walked into this kitchen, and it was like, oh my gosh, like this is what we want the feel to be, because it was all, you know, nice wooden surfaces, very warm, light. And our kitchen is not just for value added, you know, it's also for, you know, we teach classes sometimes, we have the public there, our farm, a big part of our farm is education. So we have groups who come, you know, to our kitchen, you know, two times a week, probably. So we didn't want it to feel kind of cold and stainless. And, but to get to the second part of the question, that was a real issue for the county, because we had a real vision about what we wanted it to feel like and what we wanted it to look like. And the county is used to seeing, you know, commercial spaces that feel really commercial and have all the stainless steel. And so, you know, the wooden countertops, they didn't really know what to do with that. And we are really lucky that at the time when we were building our kitchen, our county was really pushing agritourism. And so we really kind of sold them on, this is going to be a space where we're going to bring people here to our farm. They're going to get to know our farm. And so we kind of sold them on working with us and being a little bit flexible with us in terms of our materials that we wanted to use and how we wanted it to feel. But it was a challenge. They came out a bunch of times. We compromised on a few things, but not too much. And I think if I had to, design anything differently, storage is all we put in what we thought was going to be more than enough storage. And, of course it wasn't enough. So we have like a shipping container out back for extra packaging and stuff that we're now using. But yeah, I really love it. It's a really amazing place to work every day. And actually can't really see this in the picture, but we actually put a house right on top. So, my family and I, we live right upstairs, which sometimes feels like the best commute in the world. And sometimes it's like, oh, I wish I could just drive away from work. So, yeah.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. I'd love to talk more, but we'll move on to some of the other audience questions. Steve, in work with the farmers and sourcing your grain, one participant was interested in further addressing the challenges of sourcing that grain with those producers. And also, in their market scheme, are you a critical, essential outlet for them, or is that more of a added enterprise?
As far as the farmers, we're for several of the farms that we work with, we're their primary purchaser of the product they grow, products they grow. Two of the farms that we've worked with, three of the farms we've worked with in the last couple of years, we're a very small part of what they sell. And the only reason I think that they ended up working with us was they were just interested in the fact that they knew where the grain was going. In fact, one of the farmers specifically, I remember having a conversation with him about that he was satisfied to actually eat something that was made from the grain that he grew when he came and bought some of our bread. So it kind of varies a little bit. Most of the farms that we work with are on the small side. One of the farms that we worked with started working with a year ago, is closer to a medium-sized farm. They farm about 4,000 acres. That sounds huge, but in the grand scheme of things. But several of the farms are 100 or 200 acres that we work with.
Very, very interesting. And one follow-up for you, Steve. Do you anticipate, is there any long-run effects might be to the baking industry with the advent of heritage grains?
Yeah, that's a loaded one. That's a long conversation. Yes, is the short answer. And basically what I would say is that heritage grain, I generally don't like to term grain into ancient, heritage, and modern, but from a discussion standpoint, it's easy. But after that, what ends up happening when we discuss heritage and ancient specifically is that that people have their viewpoints around it, and there's a demonization to some degree of modern wheat. The problem I have with the demonization, and the reason that I think heritage has a role though, is as we start to find out more research about what is really causing the gluten sensitivity and allergy issues around autoimmune disease and such forth, I think my best estimate is that we're going to see that heritage is part of the solution because of the chromosome makeup of that particular grain. And there's an answer there to some degree, but it's a short-term answer. And the reason it's short-term is we start to look at the larger food system. The farmer can't produce enough grain if we were to go to only heritage and ancient grain because the yields are so low. And if we start to look at that, how are they going to make money? But also, how are we going to feed enough people? So it becomes a balancing act of modern hybridized wheat with grain that is grown that is not going to necessarily have these sensitivity issues. So there, it's kind of it's all over the board in terms of looking at it, depending on your perspective and how you want to approach it. But I do think there's a role for heritage, especially as a bridge grain, to help us get to a point where we start to look at it, and it's disrupting the system to some degree on a very small level, because we're starting to talk about flavor, which for me as a baker is the primary aspect of what I'm looking to achieve, is what does the grain taste like and how does it perform? And heritage grain is definitely a different flavor and performing grain in general than modern wheats. It tends to be weaker, and it tends to have a very unique flavor profile. So from that standpoint, I think it's a wonderful kind of bridge grain. But I think looking at it long term, yeah, we're kind of in the midst of this discussion of what wheat is and what it looks like in the future.
Yeah, very exciting. Let's turn to California again. A question came in on cottage food processors. They were said that there was some allowances for cottage food producers. Do you have any experience of that, Jenna or Charmaine?
So we thought about actually just doing a cottage food industry, and it varies by county. So the rules are on, you know, California kind of legalized cottage food industries, is my understanding, but then the counties would each make up their own set of rules for how they wanted to sort of apply that in the county. So in Yolo County, where we are, it was really restrictive. So, you know, I think for jam, it had to be like, I don't remember this, but it had to be like twice the amount of sugar to fruit in order for you to be able to produce it in a home kitchen in a not certified space. So for us, we just felt like we didn't want, the restrictions were too much. I think it works well for people who are doing some baked goods like cookies or breads, but it didn't work very well for pickles, jams, or anything that might, you know, have any kind of food safety issue.
That's the main definition of cottage foods, means low, minimal risk products. And so it excludes a whole bunch of products such as the pickles, mm-hmm. and nut butters and a whole variety of things that farmers would want to produce. But it can be a good entree or a testing point for somebody, a farmer who's interested and wants to just kind of check out, well, what can I do to maybe see if I've got interest in really taking on this whole new challenge and marketing a whole lot more processed products ourselves.
Can I jump in on that? Minnesota actually has a cottage food law as well, and it's by the entire state. It's based on the amount of sales, and as Jenna mentioned, it can be produced in a house, but as Charmaine also said, there are limitations. Pickled items, canned goods are prohibited. But you, as Jenna mentioned, you generally are going to see baked goods. And up until, I believe, 2015, it was unregulated for the most part. And finally, the state put in a couple of new criteria. One was that everyone who sold their goods through the cottage food law, they had to register with the state. And the second one was they had to take a food safety class, food manager certificate. But there's no real inspection or verification, because the state just doesn't have the resources to follow up with it.
And one more quick comment on that. I believe in California, there's actually a limit to what your gross sales can be. So that can be really limiting for a farm who's really looking to add some value. You know, if you can only, you know, I don't remember what the number is, but I think it was 50,000.
50,000.
Yeah. So if you're making more than that, then it sort of disqualifies you.
Well, very good. I think we'll close the questions and move forward to finish out our webinar, and we'll have more information coming up at the end on getting the slides and links to all the information that was presented today. Looking to the future, our next scheduled Ag and Uncertain Times webinar is slated for December 18th. We're going to deal with farm stress, where do we stand, and we'll be providing more information on that. And if you, to talk about future topics, we are very interested in hearing from you on future topics, and either send us a note in the chat box as you've been putting in your questions, or please send an email to the information@farmmanagement.org address, and we'd love to hear your needs and interests and opportunities and challenges for the future. The recordings and other information are available at the Ag and Uncertain Times website. It's given there. It's very easily found through a Google search. I've done it many times. And if you're interested in a copy of today's presentation slides, they will also be available for download. And so here's the file share that we just moved over into the active part of the screen. And if you're interested in a copy of the presentation slides, they are available for download at that site. Just click on that and you'll be able to download that immediately. So I'd like to again thank Shermaine, Rob, Jenna, and Steve for a wonderful presentation. It was a fascinating topic. We really enjoyed hearing about your personal enterprises and how you got those launched off the ground and the challenges that you faced in keeping them running and looking to the future. So with that, we'll close the webinar and thank you for your participation and look forward to either talking to you by email or in the future webinars.